Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
You're listening to the Seattle Puck Talk on SeattleSimbin.com. Your host, Neil Roberts, is behind the main mic for you, joined by Doug Taylor once again. Doug, how are you feeling tonight?
I am doing just fine. I am basking in the glow of my stupid dumb luck of picking the Chicago Blackhawks to win the Stanley Cup Final in six games. Nailed it. Very pleased. Not that it matters. It was stupid dumb luck. And the Blackhawks have won their two other Stanley Cups recently in six games.
So you were going off of a trend there, I'm guessing.
Little bit. No, it worked out. And it was a fascinating series. Lots of things that went on. And very entertaining, even if there was less scoring, I think, than a lot of people thought there would be. Big win for the Blackhawks, especially on home ice for the first time in 77 years. People were really thrilled, and seems like the Windy City is still really just thoroughly enjoying the euphoria of a cup win, especially at home. So,
well, as we Seattle Seahawks fans discovered, winning a championship feels pretty damn good.
It does.
So before we really dive into this, I want to congratulate you on predicting the Blackhawks victory in six games correctly. Sports are weird like that sometimes. That prediction took place on sportswithneil.com in our Stanley Cup preview. I will link to that in the article. That being said, I want to take a moment here to talk about a fantastic human being, a force for higher education that the state of Washington lost in this past weekend on Saturday, June 20th. Dr. Ellison Floyd, the president of Washington State University, passed away from complications of colon cancer at the age of 59. This is a man that transformed Washington State University. He was came in right before the financial crisis of 2008 hit. He managed to prevent major tuition hikes that you saw at other in-state universities. He managed to shield the majority of the colleges from massive budget cuts. One of the ways he did that was by recombining the College of the Arts and the Liberal Arts and the College of the Sciences into the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, which is what I graduated from. He was a fantastic human being. He cut his own salary by $100,000 once the budget hit, before he started cutting costs towards the university and stuff like that. He was fantastic with the students. I myself interacted with him on a couple of occasions. My first go was back in the spring 2012. I was doing an essay for English 101 and a COM 105, which is public speaking project on the impact of college athletics in universities. And I thought, well, here's a guy who's been a president at two different universities before he took over here in Pullman. And he probably has a pretty good idea, I would think, of what athletics mean. And so I reached out to his office and sent an email, and within 10 minutes his secretary Ginger got back to me, and she said he's got a slot in 2 days. I emailed him on Monday. He had a slot on Wednesday at 4 o'clock. Would you be available for that time? Absolutely. Now what I thought it was a 10 minute hole in his schedule. No, they gave me a full hour with him in his office. We sat down, he answered my questions, gave me a couple of print handouts. Unfortunately, I don't have those anymore. And then we just talked about college football. We talked about, you know, my life as a Washington State University fan. My parents both graduated from WSU in 1987 on May 9th. I graduated on May 9th, 2015. So there's family history to that university. And we talked about some of the Apple Cups I remember, including the controversial ending to the 2002 one, which probably kept WSU out of the BCS championship game. Although, granted, with the way that Rose Bowl turned out against Ohio State, it's probably a good thing. The next time I interacted with him, I emailed Ginger in September of that year to try and see if Floyd would come onto my first episode of Sports with Neil to talk about his vision for the university and how he saw athletics go rolling into that. And he was in Olympia at the time in meeting, back-to-back meetings, and he took 10 minutes out of that his day to try and call in to KUGR's phone and do the interview with me. And unfortunately, KUGR's phone didn't work, and that's one of the reasons I jumped on board with the station's leadership and board of directors to see if I could help make sure the station had enough money to keep its equipment up to date. And so, you know, without that call, without that interview, I probably wouldn't have taken the exact same path I did, in that I would have been one of those DJs who just sat around and did my show, didn't do much other than that, and some live sports calls. And then the last time I saw President Floyd when he was looking healthy was in October of this year. I was having quite a stressful time. KUGR was having an event. The event was not going super well, to put it bluntly. And Floyd walked by, and he saw that I was looking stressed, put his hand on my shoulder, squeezed it, and then kept walking because he had a timeline to keep, because it was before the homecoming football game against Cal. And then, you know, he was round. He had a rounder face. He looked normal. And then the next time I saw him after that would be graduation, where he'd probably dropped about 50 to 60 pounds from when I saw him in October. And it was clear something was wrong. That was a topic of conversation among us in the crowd before and after. He was not stand, at least for my graduation ceremony, I heard during the 11 o'clock that he was in the receiving line after you received your degree case, not the actual degree because that's mailed to you. But he was sitting in his chair, although he did take 5 minutes and go around and shake hands with students and wave at everybody who was still sitting and not sent up to get their cases and had their name read and all that. So it wasn't too surprising that a couple weeks ago when the university announced that he was battling cancer and he was taking medical leave of absence, it was something that we had speculated about. I had hoped it was just stress from the med school, but I knew better. And now we've lost a great man, and, you know, I think a force for education in this state. So I'll let you jump on that, Doug, if you have any thoughts.
Well, I have never had any encounters with the man, and my condolences to his family. May he rest in peace. But I could see not only from your instances and encounters with him, but also seeing many others, even, you know, other former Wazoo students and even folks who are in the news, all recounting the interactions that they had had with Dr. Floyd. He seemed to be a man who was very generous with his time and with his work, and was very supportive of all of the things going on at his university, the things that made Wazoo and make Wazoo the place that it is. So it was really sad to hear the news. I would have to think, and you know, I hate to speculate, but that he was undertaking this fight for a lot longer than he let on. Simply, he just kind of pushed forward, kept fighting, and then when it was clear he couldn't really work anymore, that was, you know, the time he took the leave of absence. So it seems as though he kept the good fight on to the end and didn't want to be a distraction to the university or anybody there. He just wanted to go about his work and his business, even if that time was limited. So again, condolences to his family and all of those at Wazoo and in the state of Washington who were affected by Dr. Floyd's life and work.
All right, so now that we've done that little sad bit, let's jump right into what we do here on Puck Talk. Again, I'll miss Dr. Floyd for a lot of reasons, but we'll move on now to Hockey for Idiots. Hockey for Idiots, that is, in case my mic glitched out there. We will be mostly talking about in this part of this segment some rules and stuff like that that are really annoying for experienced hockey fans to see broken, some mental mistakes that we were talking about before the podcast began. Doug, what do you got for us?
Well, the main issues, I mean, and this is really the case in any sport, are not physical mistakes. You know, if somebody, whether it be in hockey, you know, if somebody goes off of their skates for some reason, or, you know, their stick breaks and the puck goes to the other team on a breakaway, those things happen. You know, you have to deal with the consequences, but, you know, they're just, you know, they're bad breaks that happen in the game. The worst things are when you self-inflict damage upon yourself and your team in some fashion. Some of the more historic cases have been to the infraction of too many men on the ice. That is, you can only have five players and a goalie on the ice at any time in even strike situations. But during line changes, when players are coming on and off the ice, sometimes things could get confused. And then as a result, a line change doesn't go well. And then somebody plays the puck who is new to the ice, and the other guy hasn't gotten back over the bench or over the boards in time. And as a result, they incur a two-minute penalty. It even cost a team a Stanley Cup. The 1979 Boston Bruins lost a Stanley Cup because of that penalty. It can be argued to the Montreal Canadiens. So it's something that is, again, it's self-inflicted. It's not something that goes, oh, well, it's just a bad break that guy came over the boards. The whole game is in front of you. And so a bad line change is something that should not happen, or a too many men penalty. It just simply shouldn't happen. And when it does, it can have great consequences.
So you go, for those who haven't listened to the last couple of Puck Talk podcasts, what is a bad line change look like, and why, in your experience or in your viewing time, do those happen?
Well, they happen usually because of miscommunication on the ice or off the ice, or even a player thinks he hears that his line is being called and it's time to get out on the ice. Because, you know, sometimes, especially, you know, when it's a more leisurely line change, that is, the puck has usually been sent to the other end in a way that doesn't incur icing, and they're able to get everybody, you know, three forwards off the ice, three forwards on the ice, everything's fine. It's when that kind of gets disrupted or somebody tries to make a change and then a puck is, you know, stolen and all of a sudden there's a bad situation that you can end up with the confusion of having too many men on the ice.
So too many men on the ice, it's kind of like the 12th man penalty in football where there's another guy on the field that's not supposed to be there.
Correct, except it is a little more complicated in that the broad majority of line changes in hockey, again, happen on the fly. They happen during the action of the game, which is unique to, pretty much unique to sports. It's one of the few that I can think of where that occurs. It'd be like having in, basketball, LeBron James has been sitting on the bench and all of a sudden his guy, he's ready to come back in. And so his guy runs to the bench and kind of tags him in and he just hops on the floor. That's a regular occurrence though in hockey to cycle guys in and out, to keep them fresh, to try and keep them rested, because you don't just have five guys out there all the time skating for 60 minutes, because then they would get worn down and give up a lot of goals and not score a lot of goals.
So in your experience, when do these line change issues happen and how often would you say in a game they occur?
Well, it depends on the team. It was something that was afflicting Tampa Bay during the playoffs. They had it happen to them a couple of times. Again, it's something that happens because something has not been communicated well enough, or something was thought to be communicated that wasn't. So somebody is kind of anticipatory, ready to go on the ice, and they know it's probably their turn, and they hop out there too early, and then everything gets out of whack. Once somebody in that situation, of that team touches the puck, and the refs are keeping count pretty clearly, and even, the opposing team's bench can also see, that something is amiss, then the play is stopped, and it's a two-minute penalty. There are other times where bad line changes don't even involve too many men, but they're mistimed or something occurs, and then all of a sudden the other team is headed towards your goalie with a breakaway because you didn't change your line well enough. And so these are things that you have to time properly and do properly in order to make sure you can make it back on defense in time to not leave your goalie all out in his zone.
So one of the things you've brought up a couple times now is that hockey, you're doing these line changes in motion. So how long do officials generally give, because I'm guessing this is subjective, teams before they call that too many men on the ice or penalty?
Well, it's not really a time situation. Like no one's like running a clock to go, oh, well, you know, it was within a couple seconds, so whatever. There are times where, you know, it seems like there are too many men and maybe it could be called and the refs kind of let it go. But usually what triggers it is that somebody plays the puck on the team with too many men. That's an immediate whistle and stop when they're able to count and go, you have six out here, not counting your goalie. And you have the puck, that's an immediate penalty right then and there. Sometimes it takes a little longer. Sometimes the refs kind of miscount, and the other team is screaming from the bench, too many men, and then they count it up and go, oh, right, yeah, you're right. There are six guys out here. All right, one of you to the penalty box. And it is. It's one guy who's picked to go. It's not as if they go, okay, it's your fault that that happened, so you go to the box. You know, the team ends up choosing a guy, usually the guy that they think is probably least valuable to them on the penalty kill, and they send him to the box.
So that seems a little unfair to me that the team who created the penalty gets to choose which player they send. Why do you think that is?
Well, because it's called a bench minor. It's a bench penalty. It is considered the whole responsibility of the bench for that penalty to not occur. So then the team, you know, it gets to select one of its own, just like what would happen if a goalie commits a penalty. He is not taken out of the game because that would obviously be too much of an advantage for the other team. So another person on the team is, you know, given to be the representative to go to the penalty box. And this can work in their favor sometimes if the team is able to kill a penalty and all of a sudden they have a puck and you're getting to even strength, and say it's your best offensive player who's maybe not so good defensively or in a penalty kill on the ice. He hops onto the ice and all of a sudden he's headed, you know, into the offensive zone to help with the play, and you have him out there with his gifts trying to score. But in the end, yeah, it's a bench penalty. As just like in sportsmanlike conduct would be, because coaches or players can do that if they get on the refs too much. The refs can call 2-minute bench minor, and somebody goes.
Well, thank you for clarifying that, Doug. That makes a lot more sense to me right now. You're listening to Seattle Puck Talk on the SeattleSenvin.com. After the break, we're going to discuss which position player is most important, how defenses can counter a passing attack that Joe talked about in our last podcast, as well as some more recent NHL news, NHL draft preview, I guess you could say. So stay tuned on the Seattle Puck Talk.
Only for a moment, and the moment's gone. Oh, my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity, dust in the wind. All they are in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind. Oh.
Welcome back on the Seattle Puck Talk. Neil Robertson, Doug Taylor coming to you on SeattleBitsenbin.com. Excuse me there for stumbling over my words. We just talked about too many men on the ice, seven men on the ice period, how that works, as well as some bench penalty rules that I had no idea about that Doug was so gracious to explain. Thanks, Doug. So we're going to dive right into this next part right here, and that's talking strategy and whatnot. So from your perspective, what position is the most important on the ice, and how does that impact a defense's ability to stop the opposing offense from scoring, especially if it's a passing-oriented attack?
The goalie.
That's it, huh? The goalie?
The goalie is the most important player on the ice. And maybe, you know, and that might even be pushing it a bit, but he is the one who can have a larger outcome or effect on the outcome of the game. That is to say, if the team is even defensively not good in front of him and they're not scoring a lot on offense, if he's, you know, standing on his head, an expression used for a guy who's just making save after save after save, and they just can't get anything past him, then all of a sudden your team goes, all right, well, our guy is, you know, doing his job, so we need to go get him some goals. And so he can have a very large impact on the game. Whereas if goalie play is bad, then, you know, it goes the opposite way. Especially if he gives up a few goals early, then they will probably pull him and put in the backup goalie. So I would say it's the goalie. It's not as if defensemen and forwards aren't important. But the goalie is the most important guy when it comes to preventing goals from happening.
Okay, so going into a little more detail about the defenseman, when you're facing a passing style attack like Joe and I discussed on the last podcast, which tends to be the Western Conference teams, what can defenses do to slow down that attack and prevent them from executing and scoring goals and getting to that goalie?
The major thing that they can do, and this is, you know, very common of defense in hockey, because passing happens. It's not as if there are like rushing attacks in hockey where it's like, okay, one guy gets the puck, you go forward this time, almost like a Red Rover sort of scenario. That isn't how it is. Everybody's, you know, they're passing, they're working to get forward. Mainly the thing that they want to do is to try and make the ice smaller. By this, I mean kind of cut off and even maybe kind of flood your players to one side. Or just in general, trying to cut off passing lanes, making sure that you're between the puck and the net. It's a major cornerstone of defensive work in hockey, is to be clogging passing lanes, to have your stick on the ice at all times. Because if you are able to do that, you're able to break up passes, you're able to make yourself larger, and to make it more difficult for teams to get open looks to shoot. So that would be, I would think, the main thing defensively, especially if you're set up in, you know, if the offense is set up headed toward your goalie in the zone, then you'll have teams, many teams will kind of close into a kind of a box in one scenario, which if you're familiar with that from basketball, you know, you have four guys who kind of form a box in and around the hoop in basketball. In hockey, it's the net, of course. And then you have one guy who's kind of a rover who's, you know, making sure to cause more trouble defensively. But they're trying to, by doing that, keep the offense outside of that box so that they're not getting good close looks. Or if guys are firing shots in from outside the box, that no one's getting a rebound in close.
So the basketball comparison that you came up with is apt, whereas the further out you are from the net, the more less likely you are to get a shot that goes in, not only because there's more men in the way, but because the shot is more difficult to make. Correct?
Absolutely, yes. If you're shooting a puck from the other end of the ice from 200 feet away, and there's a goalie in net, it is darn near impossible to score, because he has a lot of time to kind of park under it or just to wait for it to come to him and to deflect it away. So you see a lot of more kind of, for lack of better words, you know, strategic defensive work, and it depends from team to team. Some teams like to do, you know, a lot of kind of more zone defensive strategic work, And they like to, you know, dive on the ice, block a lot of shots. Other goalies, they don't really want their defensemen to be totally in their way. They can handle the puck and deal with it just fine. So they want to be able to see. So they'll be kind of more in a man-to-man scenario. So basically what you're trying to do is to clog up passing lanes to make it difficult for the offensive team to get to the net or to get an open look at the net.
So just a second ago, you brought up zone, a zone defensive kind of scheme. Would it be something similar to what you see in basketball where you'll have like a 3-2 with the defense on a basketball team designed to put two guys up top and three guys along the baseline to prevent those corner shots or whatever?
I don't think I've really seen that. But the principles are kind of similar in that you're trying to take places away, or you're trying to make the, you know, in the case of a zone defense in basketball, you're just daring an opponent's team to go, okay, well, you're not going to get in close, so go ahead and shoot outside shots, because that's all you have. Your inside stuff is taken away. So more it is trying to make things smaller to keep the puck kind of contained in a certain area, and then to kind of outnumber guys there, or to make sure, again, that passes are not getting where they need to go. And then, of course, once you do that, to start breaking in the other direction.
So would you say that defense in hockey is just as key to, in getting quickly in transition to offense, is just as important as it is in basketball?
Certainly, yes. Yeah, I mean, when you're on defense, everybody's on defense. It's not as if you have the two defensemen and the goalie and they do the defensive stuff and the forwards are just waiting, you know, cherry picking at the other net. Come on, guys, get the puck down here. Everybody's involved in doing the work and making sure that that puck does not end up in the back of their own net. So,
okay. So that's really what all the questions I had for going forward here for the defensive kind of scheme you'll see. You wanted to talk about the NHL draft, which is coming up in the next couple of days. So I'll let you do that. Some quick thoughts to wrap this sucker up.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of events in the NHL calendar that are coming up. The NHL draft is coming this weekend or toward the end of the month. It's not far. You know, the top two teams, let me see if I remember this correctly. The Edmonton Oilers are picking first. And it's lost on me who is picking second for some reason. Buffalo, of course, because they had the terrible season, the Buffalo Sabres. And they kind of, they tanked. Let's be honest. That's what they did. The players didn't tank, but they tried. You know, they basically, oh, you're a good player. We're going to trade you for draft picks to try and get that first pick. It didn't really work out, but they'll end up with a second. And it's kind of a loaded draft. The two guys that are getting talked about a lot are Connor McDavid, who's kind of a junior hockey phenom. He played for the Erie Otters in the Ontario Junior League this year. I know Erie's in Pennsylvania, but they're still in the league. And he's kind of, people almost consider him to be the next Gretzky. He's, you know, he's this wondrous offensive talent. You know, even though he's, you know, basically 18 years old, he's going to step on the ice in the NHL day one and contribute in Edmonton, even if they don't win, to at least make it entertaining. And everybody tends to think that that's who Edmonton's going to pick. If they don't pick him for some strange reason, and I sure don't think that's going to be the case, then they will very likely pick Jack Eichel, who is a forward from Boston University, another very talented young player. And so, you know, they're going to, you know, Buffalo's going to probably end up with Jack Eichel, who, you know, is a very good player. A lot of teams toward the top of that draft are going to end up with contributing pieces. A lot of guys who are probably going to contribute, if not this year, but certainly in the very near future, including the Arizona Coyotes, who will be picking third in the draft this year. So lots of things going on there as well. July 1st is the beginning of the NHL free agency, kind of the opening of the new year. And so this year, it's kind of thin. There aren't a ton of big major guys who are unrestricted free agents. That is, guys who can just sign anywhere. Probably one of the top guys is Devin Dubnyk, the goalie, who played for the Minnesota Wild, kind of led them on a big long run this year out of nowhere. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how that all unfolds. But there are no like big ticket major stars who are out there full free agents. Yeah, things are already on the go in the NHL, or they will be very soon. July 1st, it's Canada Day, so it's already a holiday in Canada. But then NHL free agency, the sports networks there, will be on the air all day bringing in the NHL free agent news. It's just sheer madness. That's all that's on the TV. It'll be fascinating to see, because it's a little thinner roster this year to work with, but they'll make do with what they can. And, I mean, once we get going on that, we are 3 months from the NHL season. It's really not that far away. It'll be on top of us before we know it. So there you go.
Okay, so I said that was going to be it before we wrap this thing up. I lied. The NHL is moving into its Board of Governor meetings this week. So I'm going to get your quick reaction on the, I know this, I promised Paul that we would leave a lot of that to him, the news discussion to him, but I want to get your gut reaction, what's going on in Glendale, as well as the apparent planned expansion to Vegas.
Okay. Well, I mean, Glendale, it's a gong show. It's a complete and utter gong show. You have a team, you have an ownership that seems to be fluctuating by the day. Who's the majority owner? Who's running the show? Nobody really quite knows. You have a city that's, you know, having second thoughts about an arena management deal that they're just kind of throwing money toward an NHL franchise. And it's just this kind of strange, ridiculous mess. And the only people that really suffer from it and have no effect on what happens whatsoever, and this ought to sound familiar, Sonics fans, are fans of the Arizona Coyotes. They love their team. They may not be a huge number per se, but they're out there, and they're the ones who are affected by it. And you know, it's even though you know people see the empty arena from time to time in Glendale, and it looks bad on TV, it does. You have fans. You have hockey in Arizona that is kind of growing. Like there's a major kind of like 15-year-old junior tournament that happens in Quebec every year. Last year, the team that won it was from Arizona. But you don't go Arizona and hockey together in the desert. So there has been some sort of growth there, and the NHL doesn't want to leave that market. And yet you have this team that could soon be homeless, depending on what the court decides. So it's all just kind of strange. And alongside of that, you have this NHL expansion. It sounds like maybe this process is opening. We don't know that for sure. Las Vegas has been, you know, plugging away, doing its work. It seems like that's been well received by the NHL. And then you have this other slot, which could end up going to Seattle. There are many folks in Canada, and especially in Quebec and in French-speaking Quebec, where they think, oh, it should be Quebec City, the return of the Nordiques. But you already have 16 teams in the Eastern Conference in the NHL. And none of the teams that moved from the West to the East a couple of years ago, those two being Detroit and Columbus, wanted to go back there because they were already in the Eastern time zone. They want to play their games in the Eastern time zone. Makes perfect sense. So expanding to Quebec just on that alone kind of imbalances the league. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And they have a big hole in the North American map that they'd like to fill. So lots of stuff going on. It'll be interesting to see where Seattle falls in it. What happens with the Coyotes? Do they stay in Arizona in some fashion with the Suns? Do they just end up staying at Glendale? That doesn't really sound like that's likely. Do they end up maybe in Portland or Seattle? Or do they just go to Las Vegas and take that expansion spot? Who knows? Not even the NHL knows. It'll be fascinating to see. Yeah, I guess that's it on my end.
So for me, what my quick thoughts on this is when I was down in Arizona last year, the number of Coyote fans I encountered increased the closer you got to the Phoenix core. So the dumbest thing they probably did was moving out to Glendale.
Oh, yes. They built on the wrong side. The major money in the Phoenix metropolitan area is on the east side in the East Valley, Scottsdale, and that portion of Arizona. So even if you moved down back downtown, because the arena that the Phoenix Suns play in and where the Coyotes originally played when they moved from Winnipeg is getting to be what would it be, like 24 years old now? So, you know, it sounds really dumb because most houses usually last longer than 25 years. But that's kind of the operating life of an arena before it becomes kind of obsolete. So Phoenix is talking about trying to build a new arena for the Suns, maybe. Those are in very early stages, those discussions, but there are people talking about it. So it sounds like the best outcome for the Coyotes would be that they move downtown in some fashion. Might not be best for folks in Seattle or in other places who want to get back into the NHL. But at the same time, if for some reason the money doesn't work out, they may have to leave. And they have to go somewhere. So who knows? It's going to be strange. There are Coyote fans, and they should be respected. Just like we as Sonics fans kind of hate it when they're like, oh, yeah, your team left because you didn't support them well enough.
Yep.
That's nonsense. And it's the same, even if, you know, it's about the Arizona Coyotes or even the Florida Panthers. Although it seems like there are more Coyote fans than there are Panther fans.
I don't know any Panther fans, and I met a lot of Coyote fans down there in Glendale, in Phoenix. Problem is Glendale's a pain to get to. Thanks for joining us, Doug Taylor, Neil Roberts, on the latest episode of the Seattle Puck Talk on the SeattleSenmen.com. Thanks for listening, Doug. Thanks for coming on.
Happy to. See you later, guys.
See you later. Have a good day, guys.